You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Megan O'Rourke, Slate's culture critic, and welcome to our audio book club. Today we're discussing Evelyn Waugh's Bride's Head Revisited, which has just been made into a major motion picture. Joining me today are Katie Royfe, a Slate contributor and NYU professor, and Troy Patterson, Slate's television critic. Thanks for coming in.
Morning.
So, Bride's Head Revisited, a book that is somewhat anomalous, we might say, in Evelyn Waugh's career, or perhaps not, a book that sharply divided critics at the time it was published and until now, I think, and a book that I had never read before, although I've read a lot of other Evelyn Waugh books. So I just wanted to start there with what are your overall opinions of the book, and how do you see, I know, Troy, that you've read a lot of Evelyn Waugh, how do you see this book fitting into the context of his career?
On that score, I am with Martin Amis, who calls it sort of a problem comedy, likening it to Mansfield Park. I'm quoting Amis now. Worrying, inordinate, self-conscious, a book that steps out of genre and never really looks at home with its putative author. I love Waugh. I think, will we agree that he's the greatest comic novelist of the 20th century? I love him for his comedy, for the keenness of his ear and dialogue. No one's ever written sort of dialogue like this, I think, that evokes characters and pins them down. Jokes are so deeply embedded to spring back. Characterization in Waugh frequently is strictly a matter of dialogue, and I appreciate that. And so I know him as the cruel, vicious, cold, beautiful, marvelous comic novelist of Scoop, of Vile Bodies, of A Handful of Dust. Bride's Head Revisited, some call his most loved book. It's perhaps also his most hated. It's certainly his most sentimental. It is this odd child.
Definitely an odd child. I mean, I like Troy, I know the Waugh of Scoop, Vile Bodies, and A Handful of Dust best. And in fact, I read those books when I was much too young to understand them. And I just thought, this man is mean sometimes. but this book is a very strange book. I mean, it's in three parts, three separate books within the larger book, a kind of tripartite structure. Originally, it was published in two parts. And it would be interesting to actually go back and look at that version. The version we read is an edited version, a version that he cut down in 1959. For publication in 1959, and that apparently has cut many passages of sort of flights of fancy and weighty editorializing and kind of waxing enthusiastic about wine and other things. I mean, he describes in the preface that we have to the book, I have the edition that the Everyman's Library edition that is kind of merchandised for the movie. So, but in that preface, they have there's a quote from Waugh saying that, you know, he wrote the book during World War II at a time of privation, and so there's a kind of gluttony to the book and a kind of.
I think it's also it is kind of interesting to think about this book a little bit as a war novel,
yeah.
Which it is,
yeah.
And it begins with the main character Charles Ryder coming to this kind of majestic ancestral home Brideshead visited accidentally in his capacity as an officer in the war. And in some way, what Troy is calling sentimentality, which I don't totally agree with because I think it's much more complicated than that, the golden glow of the past is seen from the point of view of this beautiful old house having now turned into this military barracks. Right. And it's about the loss of a certain kind of Edwardian, you know, and post-Edwardian England.
Right.
And I think that the character of Charles Ryder is much darker and, you know, there's something deeply nihilistic and sort of dark in this book that belies. I think it's easy to say, oh yes, it's sentimental, but I do think it's much more complicated than that.
What you say about the Edwardian, he also talks when Ryder is stationed at the house, he also mentions that the house might have been torn down were it not for the war, that there's a kind of irony that the war in some ways kept these houses alive. So if we weren't going to say, if we're going to put sentimentality on hold for a moment, we should come back to that. Would you call it nostalgic at least? I mean, is there a nostalgia that you would say is infusing the book, or do you not even?
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's complicated in a lot of different levels. I mean, even when Charles Ryder and Sebastian Flight, the two main characters of the book, are at Oxford, they are already part of a world that is falling apart, that is threatened, and you already feel all the way through the book when they go away for they spend this idyllic summer in this country home and drink champagne and have this idea, you know, this moment together, it's already threatened. There's already a definite sense of threat. So the nostalgia is for a world that's already lost. I think it also says something complicated about being young and about the relationships you have when you're young. And there's a line, Sebastian's younger sister says love doesn't exist in the past tense, which is clearly meant ironically, which is clearly part of this book is about the forgetting and the betrayal and the moving on from people we have loved or from people who no longer function in the world. And I think that there's something kind of brutal about it, actually, when you look at this message, which really is almost the opposite of love doesn't exist in the past tense.
Well, I want to, Troy, tell us more about why you think it's sentimental, and maybe we can kind of root it more and we can talk a little bit more about what happens over the course of the book and what the structure here is.
May I begin by agreeing with Katie and sort of saying that there is a sort of layered nostalgia to the book. First, sort of a nostalgia for youth, and then book one here is titled Et in Arcadia Ego, a sort of a mourning for a fallen world, both the simplicity and beauty and languor of late adolescence and the sort of world of an English aristocracy that Waugh, snobbishly to some minds, felt was falling into the past. But before we begin squabbling about all that, maybe we should talk about the plot a little bit.
Yeah, let's talk about the plot a little bit. I mean, so we have Charles Ryder, whom Katie mentioned, who is our narrator, and who is a member of the English aristocracy in some sense, but not quite. No, he's not. He's not. Okay, I was confused about that because at first I was like, he's not.
He's from a sort of good family.
Yes, I should have said from the upper class.
He's not.
He's upper middle class.
He's upper middle class, but not aristocracy. Right. But then there is the actual aristocracy, which he has a kind of longing for, sort of the same way that. I don't know, as many people would have a longing for the kind of golden lights of whatever the social scene were, right? So we have him, and he's the first book is set at Oxford, where he befriends Sebastian Flight,
a rather
flighty young teddy bear-toting gentleman.
Exactly. At Oxford in 1923, our hero, the book is subtitled The Sacred and Profane Memories of Captain Charles Ryder. He goes up to Oxford, where he meets, first by rumor, Sebastian Flight, the second son of an aristocratic English family, importantly a family of Catholic aristocrats, sort of cuts a dandyish figure across campus, sort of toting a teddy bear, keeping outlandish company.
He's very beautiful, too. He has a kind of, he's all of the Grecian beauty of youth, right?
Yes. Strikingly beautiful. Sebastian and Charles meet cute when Sebastian vomits inside of Charles' dorm room window. To make up for this, Sebastian sends flowers. It would seem acres and acres of flowers get stuffed into this common room. And the two hit it off. We are to understand, although the book
only makes the sort of mildest nods in the direction that this relationship is romantic. And
so romantic, though not sexual, I think.
I think. I wondered.
It's a little ambiguous.
Let's talk about that.
We'll come back to it. Yeah. I have no doubt that the relationship is sexual, not least.
Yeah.
I think that man-on-man sex is sort of rather common in and probably still is in British public schools.
Yeah.
I think that may be slightly a stereotype. But yes, go on. In
any event, Charles admires Sebastian and sort of gets drawn into the world of Sebastian and his family, the whole family being sort of – there's a general air of dissolution about things. The parents are not together. The father, Lord Marchmain, having had an affair with a dancing girl and decamped for Italy, the mother being Catholic will not give him a divorce. Sebastian has three siblings. There's an older brother named Brideshead who is very dull, very earnest, very pious. His great hobby is collecting matchbooks. Sebastian has two younger sisters, the older of whom, Julia, resembles him closely and who later in the book, Charles will fall in love, have an affair with. And then there's a baby sister, Cordelia, who is as pious as Brideshead, but quite a bit sharper and more tart as a child.
And both Sebastian and Julia describe themselves as heathens at one point or something like that. They have a more ambiguous relationship to the church.
Right.
The only thing I would interject to that is that it is a Catholic family, but it's a recently Catholic family, right? Isn't the mother...
The father,
right, I'm saying the mother asks the father to convert, basically. So his line was not, in fact, Catholic, and they have been converted to Catholicism by the matriarchal figure.
Yes. But importantly, it's... such beliefs have been instilled in all the children.
Absolutely.
The action really gets going once sort of Sebastian's youthful drinking and debauchery develops into sort of outrageous dipsomania, sort of three-day-long drunks and stealing from his friends. And Sebastian ultimately ends up in a kind of self-exile.
Mm-hmm. And then basically Charles is left to pick up the pieces and create his own life. And Charles has been forever touched, we feel, by his relationship with Sebastian, but more importantly by his encounter with the Marchmain family. And he becomes – one interesting strain in the book is Charles's vocation, which proves to be architectural painting, which we can talk about in a little bit because that's sort of a fascinating strain of the book, I thought. But as Troy said, right, he ends up falling in love with Julia and having an affair that is ultimately an affair of thwarted passion, as Cordelia calls it. But one thing that this sort of strange tripartite structure has is that near the end of the book, Charles is now 10 years older sort of by the end, and then in the epilogue, 20 years older. There's quite a bit of time goes by. Troy, you may have the chronology more accurately. You're making a funny face. Is it 15 years? I mean, by the time that he and Julia...
Well, there's sort of a couple jumps. That
right.
10 years pass.
Within the context of the book, and then the epilogue is
yeah.
20.
10 years pass before Charles and Julia reconnect.
Right.
And then
two more.
There's a conversation that catches us up on the 2 years that they've
right.
spent having this open affair.
Right. Right. And then in the very epilogue, we're back in 1945, I believe. I guess it's not 45. It's in the 1940s. We're in the middle of the war.
Right.
And it's England. We're
in the early 1940s.
Right. And, you know, we were talking about before kind of how youth is a sort of touchstone in the book. And Troy, you mentioned sentimentality. So I thought I would just read very quickly a passage on page 69, which epitomizes a certain kind of strain in the book of self-consciously romantic prose that Waugh talks about a bit in the preface to the book that he wrote later. It sort of doesn't always sit that well with the other parts of the book that are more typical of his kind of caustic satire and a sort of aims of verisimilitude. But I thought we could just get a taste of this. So on page 69 of the Everyman edition, Chapter 4 begins, "The languor of youth, how unique and quintessential it is!" Exclamation point. How quickly, how irrecoverably lost. The zest, the generous affections, the illusions, the despair, all the traditional attributes of youth, all save this, come and go with us through life. These things are a part of life itself, but languor, the relaxation of yet unwearied sinews, the mind sequestered and self-regarding, that belongs to youth alone and dies with it. Perhaps in the mansions of limbo, the heroes enjoy some such compensation for their loss of the beatific vision. Perhaps the beatific vision itself has some remote kinship with this lowly experience. I, at any rate, believed myself very near heaven during those languid days at Bride's Head. One thing that runs through the book is this kind of cosmological language of heaven and passion and suffering and, you know, thwarted passion. And one of the central tensions in the book is that Charles is not a Catholic, and he, early on, the mother of the family says, oh, we must convert Charles. He must become a Catholic. And Waugh himself described the book as being about the kind of operations of divine grace on this, what he called a diverse cast of characters. And just to kind of delve more deeply into the, you know, what we think of the book and questions of sentimentality, I mean, there are kind of two different things going on in this book. When I read more about the book afterward, it seemed to me that Waugh had a certain kind of idea for the book, which had to do with anatomizing this operation of divine grace, showing the actions of grace, showing how religion, how belief and how faith affected these characters. But then there were a whole, on the kind of level of what was actually happening in the book and what was often the most, to me as a reader, the most engaging moments, these themes were more memory, you know, loss, youth, love, different kinds of love, and the privations of love, and questions about kind of, you know, how one's sense of one's patrimony kind of become sort of shrivel up, and also, you know, lost ambitions. And I just wondered what you guys thought about
right.
those things.
I mean, I think you're right. I think one can also look at the religion, to me, as partly about family. In a way, this is a story about Lady Marchmain, who is this sort of very complicated, charismatic, and almost sinister character, but also sort of tragic. And she's one of the more complicated characters in the book. And it's about her influence on her different children. And Sebastian kind of poignantly is trying to run away from his family. He says to Charles, I don't want to introduce you to them. I don't want you to meet any of them because they'll take you in. And then he's right. Charles does get taken in by the family. And so all of the characters in their own way are trying to evade this family and end up not being able to evade this family. And so I think in a way the religion and the religious themes are part of that story, which is this family saga about, which is, again, another part of this idea of youth, which is how do you get away from your family and how you never really get away from your family. And they're sort of trapped. And the religion is, in a way, the ultimate expression of this family's ethos.
Yeah. I mean, did you find that completely fully drawn? Like, there were times in the book where I was like, okay, I'm reading a costume drama. You know, there were times when I felt everyone so elaborately garbed and all of the details so laid out. But I love that scene where Sebastian is, you know, he brings Charles home for the first time and he's just getting more and more anxious and he has to flee. And Charles is completely baffled by it. And that seems really, you know, you see that this is a character who just, it's like the Bride's Head Castle is like kryptonite for him. You know, it's like the closer he goes, the more unsebastian-like he becomes in some sense. But then what happens over the course of the book? I mean, did you feel that you get a really clear sense of what it is about this family, other than the Catholicism, that is so poisonous for Sebastian?
I think it's a very complicated question, because in a way it's about what's poisonous about any family.
Right.
And it's about it's the very magnetism and closeness and intensity and sort of this pressure to be extraordinary in this family that, you know, is it poisonous? Is there something so terrible about Lady Marchmain? I mean, we have different characters giving different perspectives on whether she's evil, whether she's innocent, whether she's a saint, whether she's, you know, and what she really is probably just sort of an ordinary woman.
Right.
And what's so poisonous about a family, when you look at this book, it's really much of its most charismatic pages are rooted in adolescence, and in adolescence, all families are poisonous. And all families are dangerous in that way.
To the developing and, identity.
Yeah,
of the
and they're seductive and they're powerful and everything in life is staked on evading that seduction and that power.
Yeah.
And so I think that this story is about that, less than something specific about this family, although obviously it's a very complicated structure. Lady Marchmaine, there's the suggestion, drove her husband away. Drives all the people she loves away with this kind of, with her charm, with her closeness, with her insistence on and love, you know, sort of smothering love.
Fine points, but what I would point to is a rather extraordinary monologue that is delivered by one Anthony Blanche, mm-hmm. a most extraordinary character, flamboyant, bitchy, and
an esthete.
A high esthete. It comes right up to the edge of being a... Well, I mean, no. I mean, he is a, sort of a camp figure. Mm-hmm. But it's also, to my mind, in a way, in a book that's very much concerned with aesthetics and good art and bad art, whether Waugh intended it or not, sort of the secular conscience of the novel.
He's certainly the aesthetic conscience of the novel, it seems. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. So there's a scene... In chapter 2 of book 1, Anthony, this is at Oxford, Anthony, a fellow student, takes our hero out to lunch and proceeds to gossip most viciously about Sebastian and his family. So here we are on page 46. Anthony Blanche, with his affected stammer, dishing on Sebastian's family. Anthony had lost his stammer in the deep waters of his old romance. It came floating back to him momentarily with the coffee and liqueurs. Real green chartreuse made before the expulsion of the monks. There are five distinct tastes as it trickles over the tongue. It is like swallowing a spectrum. Do you wish Sebastian was with us? Of course you do. Do I? I wonder. How our thoughts do run on that little bundle of charm, to be sure. I think you must be mesmerizing me, Charles. I bring you here at very considerable expense, my dear, simply to talk about myself, and I find I talk of no one except Sebastian. It's odd, because there's really no mystery about him except how he came to be born of such a very sinister family. I forget if you know his family. Now there, my dear, is a subject for the poet. For the poet of the future, who must also be a psychoanalyst. And perhaps a diabolist, too. I don't suppose he'll ever let you meet them. He's far too clever. They're all charming, of course, and quite, quite gruesome. Do you ever feel there's something a teeny bit gruesome about Sebastian? No? Perhaps I imagine it. It's simply that he looks so like the rest of them, sometimes. There's Brideshead, who's something archaic, out of a cave that's been sealed for centuries. He has the face as though an Aztec sculptor had attempted a portrait of Sebastian. He's a learned bigot, a ceremonious barbarian, a snowbound llama. Well, anything you like. But not Julia. Oh, not Lady Julia. She is one thing only, Renaissance tragedy. You know what she looks like? Who could help it? Her photograph appears as regularly in the illustrated papers as the advertisements for Beecham's pills. A face of flawless Florentine Quattrocento beauty. Almost anyone else with those looks would have been tempted to become artistic. Not Lady Julia. She's as smart as... Well, as smart as Stephanie. Nothing greeny-yallery about her. So gay, so correct, so unaffected. Dogs and children love her. Other girls love her. My dear, she's a fiend. A passionless, acquisitive, intriguing, ruthless killer. I wonder if she's incestuous. I doubt it. All she wants is power. There ought to be an Inquisition especially set up to burn her. There's another sister, too, I believe, in the schoolroom. Nothing is known of her yet, except that her governess went mad and drowned herself not long ago. I'm sure she's abominable. So you see, there's very little left for poor Sebastian to do except to be sweet and charming. It's when one gets to the parents that a bottomless pit opens. My dear, such a pair.
that's the version, that's the 1944 version, which is great to hear because it's way more over the top than the version that, that we have, which is itself over the top. One of my very favorite descriptions, and this is the passage you just read from Troy, is really one of the knockout passages in the book. And it had been about 10 years since I had read any Waugh, and you know, you get to this passage and you just think, this is Evelyn Waugh at his best. I mean, this is just what you were saying when we kicked off the discussion, the absolute characterization and the movement of the plot through dialogue. You know, I thought, wow, if I taught writing and people didn't know how to write dialogue, this is the book that I would, the first book of this tripartite, you know, book is what I would give them, because the dialogue is just so pitch perfect and absolutely verging on caricature-ish or over the top, but not, you know, but never quite going all the way there. And this, he is a campy figure, this Anthony. But one of his one of my favorite descriptions comes a little bit later when he's describing Lord Marchmain. He says, "Well, a little fleshy, perhaps, but very handsome. A magnifico, a voluptuary, Byronic, bored, infectiously slothful. Not at all the sort of man you would expect to see easily put down." Which is just, you know, right away you have this complete sense of who Lord Marchmain is, long before we get to him and his kind of Italian, decadent Italian digs. And Waugh doesn't have to do the characterization through stepping back, kind of laboriously setting it all out. It's just there through conversation. But yes, why did you want to read us this passage?
Gotcha. Well, I might first mention that, so I suppose I'm reading from the 1944 edition, which you can buy in a bookshop. There's a handsome edition by Back Bay Books. I would also say that Frank Kermode, in the introduction to this Everyman's Library edition, the 1959 edition, summarizes the changes as Waugh's having cut out the grosser passages, trimming some nostalgic accounts of luxurious eating and drinking, and also instances of what Connor Cruz O'Brien, in an essay that mildly upset Waugh, referred to as elegiac afflatus.
That was my favorite.
I read you that by way of indicating sort of some of the richness of this book, which for good and sometimes for ill is unlike anything else in Waugh's body of work, and also by way of trying to begin groping and crawling towards some understanding of this peculiar family and what's wrong with them. I worry that partly what's wrong with them is that they've been made to become actors in this drama about the grace of a Catholic God that I cannot entirely swallow.
Yes, I share that worry. I thought that the book, you know, if we're just talking as readers, you know, the first half of this book had a kind of momentum and quality of observation through passages like this, through dialogue, through the moment when Julia is bringing Charles to the home and Sebastian has broken a tiny bone in his foot and he can't bear to be bored and alone. So he summons Charles sort of peremptorily from London, and Charles is all too happy to come along and be his, you know, sort of entertain Sebastian. And there's a moment where Julia, you know, asks Sebastian to light a cigarette, and asks Charles to light a cigarette and passes it to her. And there's this kind of little sexual charge. And there are just all these moments like that of intense characterization and sense of what a family, the different characters in a family are like and how they play out these mini dramas with one another. But I did end up feeling that they become pieces on a chessboard about, in this sort of game that's being played out about Waugh turning the tables on Charles, the agnostic, and in such a way that Charles goes from seeming like the person who knows everything, who has a kind of informed skepticism about the superstitious beliefs of these strange Catholics and their God, and ends up, as he intimates at the very beginning of the book and more foreshadows as the book progresses, becoming a believer himself, because I think that is what happens to Charles.
Indeed. And I think we're meant to be left with the idea that, you know, the book's told in this frame, and that part of the large part of Charles Ryder's unhappiness as he's a British officer looking back at his beautiful youth is that he hasn't let God into his life. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that this is that Waugh wasn't interested in any sort of like dialogue or skepticism in these matters. He converted to Catholicism in 1930 after the dissolution of his first marriage.
And he himself sort of acted much as Julia does at the end of the book. Julia insists on having a the last rites performed for her father. And I believe Waugh himself did that for a friend of his who was a writer. And, you know, kind of, right, as you say, there was not – he didn't want a dialogue. He was profoundly concerned about hell and about salvation and a believer.
Again, I agree with you that the Catholicism to me is not as interesting as other things in the book. I think Waugh, like his friend Graham Greene, had a slightly complicated relation to religion in that, not that he wasn't a believer, but that he had a very sophisticated way of using the idea of religion, especially in his novels. And I think that what the religion means in this novel, it, you know, in a way, it's about unhappiness. It's about not being able to live in the world. None of these religious characters end up happy. Mm-hmm. There's Cordelia, who sort of becomes this spinster-like nurse figure. There's Julia, who has to live alone because she can't be married within the church. There's Lady Marchmain, who lives alone. There's, I mean, pretty much everybody. Sebastian, who becomes an alcoholic and goes off to live in this sort of monastery in Morocco. And there's not really happiness in this religion. It's sort of like earthly suffering.
Well, I
think that it's partly, I think he's using it in a way that what this religion means has something to do with not being able to live in the world.
Yeah, but there's something, these people have the sort of the pleasure of a certain kind of martyrdom then, don't they? They may not be able to sort of live in this world, but it's a fallen world anyway. And they believe, and I believe that Waugh believes, that heaven exists and they get to go to it.
It is one of the strange things reading the novel if you are, I mean, I come from a Catholic family, but I'm not myself a devout Catholic. But it is one of the strange things reading the book because you begin with the perspective of the agnostic, and then there is, in some ways, this transformation. At the very end of the book, one of the ways that we know Charles has become something of a believer is that when he's revisiting Brideshead as a in the army, he moves through the house, which is a fallen, which is now the kind of symbolic edifice of the fallen world. The house itself is fallen and sort of decrepit in certain ways, and has been, you know, its beautiful Art Nouveau sculptures and various other things have been sort of pushed aside to make room for commanding officers and so forth. But at one point, he goes to the chapel and he falls to his knees, and there's a light burning in the house. The house itself is in shambles, but there is still a lamp burning in the chapel. Talk about symbolism. He says, "There was one part of the house I had not yet visited, and I went there now. The chapel showed no ill effects of its long neglect. The Art Nouveau paint was as fresh and bright as ever. The Art Nouveau lamp burned once more before the altar. I said a prayer, an ancient, newly learned form of words, and left, turning toward the camp." And I think that's the moment where we are to believe that, you know, he's falling to his knees to pray, you know, or to say the catechism or offer up something. But what's very strange about it is that, I mean, what's strange for me reading the novel is that they have the pleasure of their martyrdom, but that might seem like an incomplete pleasure to many readers. I mean, it seemed an incomplete pleasure to me. It also seemed, just on a very basic level in terms of exposition, sort of hasty. There was something kind of like the first part is so completely drawn, and at the end everything just kind of started to get hastier and hastier, and I had the feeling of Waugh looking at his calendar, realizing he had to get back to his position in the army, kind of wrapping up. That may be unfair.
Maybe this is where I think, actually, in terms of the way time passes,
it
might be useful to think of a book like To the Lighthouse,
right?
Which also has the destruction of a house,
right?
Which also has these three different sections working in different ways. But part of the suddenness and the abruptness and the way that he uses time, I think, in this book is something he's saying about
how
about
we experience
loss.
Time.
Yes,
yeah, no,
about
absolutely.
Loss and
that's
how
a great point.
Things change in a way. I mean, part of what this novel is about is like the irrevocable change, both in who we are and in what happened and what it means to us and all that, and the sort of incredibly disorienting, painful way that that occurs in life. And I think, in a way, that suddenness, Julia, suddenly like, wait, my father died, now I can never see you again.
Right.
Even though it's sort of convenient narratively, which might be what you're objecting to, it also has – there's something real about it in
there
the way in what he's doing with time,
I totally agree.
And he's doing something interesting with time here in that – in the way that he – I mean, even in that passage Troy was talking about where he does the 2 years, he skips suddenly to it's 2 years later and they spent this – they had this affair. It creates a sort – it says something about what that affair means and how it works and –
I totally buy that. And actually, a book that it made me think of was Tender as the Night, which also has this kind of incredible limpidity at the opening, you know, and then you sort of feel – I mean, I think that book is more flawed in it structurally perhaps than this is on the face of it. But it also – it is. I mean, I buy that. I mean, there is something about the kind of languors and longness of youth and the intense recollections of college and then the kind of foreshortened – but the other reason I wanted to read that passage about the chapel is that one thing that's so striking about this book, and Troy touched on it earlier, is that it's not – it's not just a book about whatever Waugh might have said about it being about the operation of divine grace. It's clearly also a book about art, right? And I mean, even in that passage, it's this, you know, description of the Art Nouveau lamp. And a lot of the passages early on and throughout are about what we make of art, the exchanges, you know, and what whether Charles is an artist or not, whether
well,
he has the guts to kind of
artist.
Become an
right.
artist,
and,
right?
And
between him and Anthony, there's this ongoing fight about
great
that.
Yeah. Is that he's a mediocre artist and that his own confrontation with his mediocrity is this sort of fierce thing that comes up throughout the book.
Yeah.
And there is that great scene, again, with Anthony at the end of the book, which we've sort of referred to, where he's been an architecture painter in England.
Charles has
all his life, and he's very successful. He writes these sort of nice English books about country houses.
Right.
And then all of a sudden he goes to Latin America and he tries to do this wild thing and do this sort of wild architecture. And he comes back and everybody says,
it's exotic, it's much
deeper. He's become a real artist. And Anthony says, oh, no, it's just traditional English charm playing with tigers.
Right.
And it's such a great moment because – and Charles says he's right, you know, knows he's right. He's like, I think you're right.
Right.
And there's this sort of – and again, this is why what I keep going back to, which I think really does save this book from sentimentality, is that's part of the darkness.
Yeah.
The way that Charles is constantly undercutting himself into this impossible nihilistic position where he doesn't even believe in, like, his own art or his own
– well,
you know, and there's something about that that I find so interesting. It's so modern, and it's also what it does is complicate all these stories. Yeah. Like, as you say, it is much more complicated than a story about divine grace. And even the scene at the end where he – in the chapel, I think you can't read as totally redemptive just given the book that's come before, that it's sort of this moment where he's like, I'm homeless, I have no love, I have nothing. You know, the passage that comes before, he says, I'm homeless, I have no childless, I have no love, I'm loveless. And, you know, it's sort of like then he passes by and they're giving out potatoes and they're like giving out boiled baked potatoes or whatever it is in the army. And it's sort of a – it's pretty cold comfort, that ending.
Except that then he sees the light and he sort of feels the glow of something upon him, and the other person says, oh, you look so cheerful today. You know, there is this kind of slightly creaky, you know, twisting into place of some realization at the end, I did think. But just to go back to that, what we were just saying, Katie, I mean, I think that one of the things that what you were talking about, this darkness or this nihilism that I kept thinking about with some of the discussions about art and some of Charles's strange feeling of being an outsider was about Waugh's own feelings of being an outsider as a Catholic, and that there's actually something quite Catholic about this book in certain ways that have nothing to do with theology, right, that have to do with more a kind of strain of kind of ritualistic sadism and sort of intensities of shading and feeling, and those were the most interesting parts to me. The non-theological kind of, you know, aesthetic Catholicism, we might call it.
Yeah, like the pageantry of it.
There's just these jokes early on that are, and Anthony is a version of it. I mean, that kind of campiness of Anthony is in some ways like a very extreme ritualized figure, and he makes these, Anthony is always making these jokes about kind of the sexual appetites of people and the sort of darker needs that people have. They're talking about Burgundy wine early on, and he sort of says to Charles, oh, I know all about your needs or something. And there's some real undercurrent of kind of appetite and longing for something that's coded aesthetically in this way that I found really interesting.
A lot of the sort of this idea isn't original to me, but a lot of the rhythms of the prose are sort of liturgical in a way as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Also the fascination with sin. I mean, this is a book that's fascinated with sin.
Yeah.
And every, like, manifestation.
And, you know, I think also the people in the book think of themselves as bad. Julia says to him, I mean, one thing we haven't talked about is, so near the end of the book, Julia, with whom Charles has had this affair for 2 years, and it seems that everything is proceeding apace for them to have the happy ending, you know, the ending of the comedy rather than the tragedy, where, you know, the houses will be united and they're getting their divorces.
It almost
they're
seems
going to
that
be
they're
going
to live in Brideshead, actually.
It really does. It seems that they're going to live in Brideshead. Everything is falling into place for sort of the traditional, a kind of twist on the traditional marriage story where they get the family home and they get their love and their happiness. But Julia's father, who's a skeptic, not a true believer, dies. And as he's having the last rites, he crosses himself. And it's kind of a sign that she's been looking for. And even Charles, watching him, has been looking for a sign. It wants to see a sign in the face of death. And I think this is really a book about death, too, and confronting death and loss, particularly loss of parents. But after that, Julia says, I can't be with you. And it's not that she's becoming, you know, kind of the, like, Michelle Pfeiffer character in Dangerous Liaisons. You know what I mean? It's she's like, I'm bad, and I'm probably going to continue to be bad, but I can't be bad in this particular way. Like, I can't marry you because that would be a kind of sin that goes so profoundly against God, and I need to kind of keep having my own sins.
Well, she can't have a happy ending. I think she can't give herself that.
She's like, I'm going to keep going, but my sins will be what they are, but this one.
Well, there's sort of a personal sense, but in order to, I mean, their marriage couldn't be legitimized by the Catholic Church.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly.
And I think that's the.
That's the
crux of her concern.
Exactly. Exactly. That the other sins she might perform, she might enact, are ones that she can confess and be forgiven for. But exactly, this is something outside of the church, and it's directly in the face of God, she says, something like that. Yeah. But just to go back to Troy, you were talking earlier about art and the sort of Anthony as a secular conscience of the book. And what did you make of that strain in the book of the architectural painting and the kind of, you know, undergraduate conversations about Roger Fry and, I don't know.
Well, I think partly, importantly, and I don't know if we're giving sort of enough sense of it, this is a book about a house, about the romance of a house, about how a house might or might not be a home, about people who sort of exile themselves from this house for various reasons, and about sort of this particular grand English castle as a representative of sort of what Waugh felt was a way of life that was being destroyed and falling
away. A heritage, really,
A lot of the aesthetic talk I find sort of interesting as someone with like a casual interest in sort of the period and sort of schools of aesthetic theory were in fashion at the time. And also, I'm going to quote Martin Amis here. There's a way in which some of the book's bits about art are perhaps a defense of the problems in the novel and perhaps a confession of them. This is Martin Amis. Bad art is, of course, a major theme in Brideshead Revisited. The book would be without much of its staying power if Waugh hadn't hedged his bets in this way. Writer's artistic talent is seen in terms of his infatuation with Brideshead itself, in terms of connoisseurship of English charm. It was an aesthetic education to live within those walls, says Ryder. This was my conversion to the Baroque. It was Waugh's conversion, too, but to the Baroque in its decadent, bastardized literary form. Quote, I've been here before, the opening refrain is from Rossetti, and much of the novel reads like a golden treasury of neoclassical clichés. Phantoms, soft airs, enchanted gardens, winged host, the liturgical rhythms, the epic similes, the wooziness. Waugh's conversion was a temporary one, and never again did he attempt the grand style. Certainly the prose sits oddly with a coldness and contempt at the heart of the novel, and contributes crucially to its central imbalance. I think that what Amis calls coldness and contempt, I think, touches on what Katie was talking about, the darkness and nihilism.
I mean, I guess I wouldn't want to end with that, because I think it's the central imbalance and the, you know, what we keep calling the strangeness of this novel is also its greatness. Like, I think that the contradictions and the way, I mean, I agree that there's something uncomfortable about it, and that there are certain parts of it that feel like they don't work together in certain ways, but that there's something interesting in this book and I love Handful of Dust, I love lots of other Waugh as well, but this is a different type of project, and I think something that's interesting here comes in that, in the contradiction, in the sort
messiness.
Of electricity, and in the messiness, and in the sort of juxtaposition of these weird things. Right. And I think the continuing popularity of this book also is sort of interesting. I mean, again, that there's a new movie, there's been other movies, there's this is the Waugh book, you know, the sort of most read Waugh book.
Is it possible that the book is popular for the wrong reasons? That because this is the most, it doesn't have the kind of unrestrained viciousness and kind of gleeful misanthropy of his other books.
But it does have lots of unrestrained viciousness and gleeful misanthropy in it. Like, for instance,
it does.
The scene where his father tortures his friend by pretending that he's an American when he comes. There are classic Waugh viciousness.
That's true. But it's mitigated by kind of a prettiness that's it's mitigated by some beauty, by a really piercing sense of nostalgia, and also by this kind of inflated prettiness, what I would say has some relationship to sentimentality, and which has a higher market value than misanthropy generally.
Yeah. I mean, it is the case, I think, that this is, I mean, I understand the use of the word imbalance or these other things. It is the case that this is a novel that seems stitched together. How I would describe it is it almost seems stitched together of passages from different genres. You know, there's something unusual about a passage like that one about youth, which is so kind of high romantic in a certain way, inflected by nostalgia or a kind of gauziness or, you know, I mean, just the use of rhetorical devices like exclamation and hyperbole, which doesn't sit that well with the kind of intensely precise caustic exchanges of the father and the son when they have their détente, you know, in London over the dinner table. But it is interesting that you know, you think about nostalgia. Nostalgia really comes from the Greek word for homesickness, and that is what this book is. I think you're absolutely right, Troy. That's what the book is about. It's about a home and the home as a symbol, a sort of synecdoche for this larger way of life that's being lost. And being lost, this is a book written during the war, as Katie was saying before, and you think about what that might have been like, that sense of how precarious everything is, and it starts to account for some of the peculiarities of it. You know, Troy, you ask whether it could be popular for the wrong reasons. I think definitely. I mean, I think that sort of wrong and right at the same time. I mean, I think part of the, like, elegiac mourning of this world of England that's being lost, that's something that people respond to. It also makes it incredibly susceptible to cinematography, yep. Right? Because it's basically so much about these textures of the clothes and the beauty. And he goes on and on about, you know, Julia's haircut and her spidery style, her spidery frame that was so stylish at the moment. And there's this kind of, you know, rubbing the gilt lamps as if to bring out the genies of the past, you know, and I go back and forth. I mean, that does seem to me to be a form of sentimentality, but it also is something that a novel can do, right? Conjure up this.
I don't know. I mean, I just think this is like the darkest sentimental book in the world. If it is, if it is a sentimental book, I mean, it is a pretty dark book with like no real. I guess I would think this is a book more about sentimentality than a book that is sentimental.
But is there not a way in which it's kind of sort of cheap that Sebastian, who's fundamentally sort of a drunk and a layabout, and his father, who's given himself over to chasing a dancing girl and just sort of enjoying his money, and Julia, who's sort of largely frivolous, have this kind of religious conversion. What have they done to earn it? You know, there's something a bit cheap there.
Yeah, I guess I'm just I'm not convinced by the religious conversion aspect. I think it's just a new form of unhappiness. They enter into a new form of unhappiness. I also think, just as someone who's lived closely with like drug addiction and alcoholism, I think this is a very realistic portrayal of alcoholism.
I did think it was.
I know what it's like to have a family member who's like that, and it is exactly like that.
Right.
And there's something kind of amazing about that, those scenes.
I was going,
That and that portrayal.
I was going to say that too. That like you, I've lived closely with it, and I, the family gathering around to kind of, you know, keep certain things from, you know, to sort of ban the cognac tray and the endless kind of little machinations and the willingness to self-deceive. He captures perfectly the family member's willingness to self-deceive about what's really happening and also what it's like to be sort of romantically involved with somebody who is just lying all the time and sort of hiding something, right? And it's funny. I mean, one thing we didn't talk about either is that, you know, there are these moments where there are these little flashes of Waugh kind of protesting certain kinds of determinism, certain kinds of like psychological determinism and certain kinds of other biological determinism that are about to flourish and take hold in the cultural imagination ways that we understand character.
There's something chemical in him.
Yes,
Julia,
there's something chemical in him. He says, I don't
Sebastian
think there's anything chemical in him. And there are these wonderful moments of him kind of these little flourishes of him sort of protesting against that and retaining for the novelist the right to see character as something that comes out of a more complex relationship to the world and the sense of grace or tenderness, which doesn't even need to be a religious feeling. It can be a more kind of ontological, like who are we as beings and what brings us there. But let's go back just for a sec before we wrap. Oh, Troy, go ahead.
Oh, no, maybe you're going back to the same place I wanted to pick another fight with Katie to wonder how it is that you think that so you don't think that Sebastian and Charles were having sex.
That's where I was going to go. Yeah, good. I want to talk about that. Let's go to the sex part of the conversation.
Strangely, I haven't given it a huge amount of thought. I just took for granted that it was in the genre of this sort of intense college romantic relationship, and whether or not they were actually sleeping together is not that important to the plot.
I got to say, I thought they were.
I think that there's no question that they are.
Because they're sort of the naked sunbathing. There are a couple of other moments. There's a moment where Charles, where the Lord Marshmain's lover, Kara, sort of says to him, there's nothing wrong with having this kind of relationship, but it must come to an end, sort of. You know, she sort of, and he gets a little bit embarrassed. And he's so withholding that I thought, well, we're supposed to understand that there's that there is a physical relationship.
There
their rooms
the
are adjoining and brides
head. The consummation of his relationship with Julia.
Yes.
Where he says, this is the final thing.
Right.
Which sort of suggests that he wasn't sleeping with Sebastian, because it sort of says, here was the consummation of this relationship he was having with both of these two people. That's part of the same relationship.
It's possible.
That's the only
actual
textual evidence. I can say that he actually does make that suggestion.
Right.
That consummation is the moment where, you know, it's sort of both her and Sebastian enacted in this moment.
Well, I mean, I would
but
say
I don't
that
I think it matters particularly for the book, frankly. Whether or not they were sleeping together. I mean, they had this intense romantic relationship, whether or not they were sleeping together in a physical sense that doesn't I mean
Yeah. Right. Well, I don't care whether or not they were fucking, but the I mean,
whether or not it's physical,
but their friendship, you know, sort of transcends the platonic.
I agree that the friendship transcends the platonic, but I just don't know whether how that actually works in the physical world. I mean, you can be physically in love with somebody. And
right. I'm glad that I don't. Wall's quite bad at sex scenes. When he writes Charles's sex scene with Julia here, he does, you know, so he writes about her narrow loins, which again sort of points towards man love in a narrow loins.
Yeah. Well, here's what he says, and I can read it either way, actually. So he says, it was no time for the sweet. They're having sex in this ship, and there's a storm, and so it's all a little bit hard to organize, I guess. So he says, it was no time for the sweets of luxury. They would come in their season with the swallow and the lime flowers. Now on the rough water, there was a formality to be observed, no more. It was as though a deed of conveyance of her narrow loins had been drawn and sealed. I was making my first entry as the freeholder of a property I would enjoy and develop at leisure, which was sort of like the, you know, home developer version of sex. But
well, it's a book about a house.
Right, it's a book about a house. No, it is, and it's his entrance to the house. Quite literally. You could read it as, therefore, his first entrance to the house through the heirs at all. But you could also imagine that he and Sebastian have been having this kind of physical relationship, but it's not sex per se. I don't know. I think we're certainly meant to feel that they are physical with one another somehow, you know, that there's some non-platonic physical romantic love.
Well, they're clearly in love with each other.
Yes. Yeah. But...
I'm glad we're ending on this elevated note.
No, this is important. If it's a book about love and friendship, would it matter in Anna Karenina whether or not
class and social status and entrance to it would matter in Anna Karenina. It does matter in Anna Karenina whether or not.
All right. Well, I guess it matters. I just don't think there's like an answer in the text itself. We're not going to find an answer. We can believe what we want to believe, but I don't think he gives us that answer.
But we believe that it's non-platonic.
The conventions of his time and the sort of don't allow him to give us an answer. But I'm looking at my book and page.
This is the 1944.
The 1944 in the Back Bay Books paperback edition. Charles is looking back at his sort of first afternoon at Brideshead, and there's a section in chapter one of book one that ends, "That day was the beginning of my friendship with Sebastian, and thus it came about that morning in June that I was lying beside him in the shade of the high elms, watching the smoke from his lips drift up into the branches." There's a sensuality there.
Yeah.
There's definitely a sensuality there.
Yeah. It's certainly not platonic. It's certainly romantic. I presumed that there was a kind of set of niceties, conventional niceties, that prevented him from making it. And I thought, actually, no, he didn't want to make it explicit. He wanted that to be a little bit, you know, just not in the text, whether, like, a clear answer, in the same way that it is clear with Julia what happens. But I believe that they were having asexual relations. Well, Katie, Troy, thank you so much for being here today to talk about Brideshead Revisited. This has been great. I want to keep talking to you. I feel there are other things in the book, like Cordelia, that we haven't touched on that we should have and will in our future. The next book the Audiobook Club will be discussing is Curtis Sittenfeld's American Wife, which is due out in bookstores at the end of August, and our book club will run around that time. For Slate.com, I'm Megan O'Rourke, Slate's culture critic. Thank you so much for joining us.